Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hello and welcome to today's LSE Festival Skills Workshop on Power and Social Change, Five Ways We Can Challenge Inequalities of Power, hosted by LSE's Marshall Institute for Philanthropy and Social Entrepreneurship. Now, this session will focus on a skills-based discussion on ways to leverage one's own power within the context of the broader social ecosystem that we operate in. And I hope you all are at the right place. So my name is Fan, and I am the Deputy Director at 100X Impact Accelerator as part of the Marshall Institute. At 100X, we believe in the power of social entrepreneurs and the positive and social and environmental change they can bring to the world, and work with such individuals and their vision to amplify impact through our accelerator program. And I am very pleased to welcome our workshop leaders and my colleagues for this session, Dr. Karen Krieger and Dr. Jonathan Roberts. And before I give the floor to them both, a quick round of introductions. Karen is senior lecturer in practice at the Marshall Institute, who has deep expertise in social entrepreneurship, especially across sub-Saharan Africa, where she spent most of her career working to shape the social economy, including through her work at the International Labour Organization, as well as the establishment of South Africa's Social Employment Fund. Welcome, Karen. Jonathan is our teaching director at the Marshall Institute and has been a visionary shaping the educational outcomes at the Institute through his role, including the creation of the groundbreaking Executive Master's Program in Social Business and Entrepreneurship. Jonathan brings a wealth of knowledge and experience through both his academic achievements, as well as dedicating parts of his career working within social organizations to bring about change. So welcome, Jonathan. Welcome both. And I will now hand over to Karen and Jonathan for this session.
Fan, thank you so much for that very, very kind introduction. And a very warm welcome to all of you who have joined Karen and me at the LSE Research Festival. It's really great to welcome you to the virtual LSE. I'm guessing that many of you will be here because, like us, you feel a bit of an unease at the state of the world just at this moment, and you want to do something in some way to make the world better. And we're going to focus on a very specific issue around that task, and that is, when we make the world better, we are exercising power in some way. And how can we manage our own power constructively to make sure the social change that we bring is as impactful and as effective and as just as possible? So that's the theme of today's workshop. And we're going to bring you a few skills by which you can think about this particular problem. So let me share my screen just to get a few slides up. Here's what we're trying to work out. If you are what we call a social change agent — it's not a term I particularly like, but if you can find a better one, please do email me. A social change agent, someone who wants to bring about social change and social justice. And I've listed a few of those sort of people just down there, and perhaps you fit into one of those categories. You are part of the system, even as you exercise change. You are part of this world, and therefore, when you are creating social change, that is in itself an exercise of power. And if one of our interests in creating social justice and a better world is reallocating and redistributing power in a just way, then we do have to reflect ourselves on our particular actions and ensure that they are consistent with what we are trying to achieve. So as we are trying to remedy the many social and environmental problems that we see in the world, how can we be sure that we are not imposing, in some sense, even unconsciously, our own worldview on other people? Just as importantly, how can we make sure that the way in which we engage in social change empowers those who have been marginalized? And managing our own power is very much part of that particular outcome, that particular objective that we are seeking. So in the course of this session, we're going to introduce a few skills by which you may be able to manage your power constructively for social good and social justice. this is where we're going to go to. I'm going to go through the first two. Then Karen is going to come in and do the middle two, and then I'll be back to talk about markets and profit. And then at the end, we do encourage people to take part in the question and answer session. There'll be about 15 minutes where we can have a really good chat about these skills and the way to manage your power. Okay, let's dive straight in. The first skill I want to introduce is maybe seems an obvious one, but it is make sure you understand the social problem that you are engaging with. Many of us have great ideas. I have many, many ideas, but ideas alone are not enough. We have to truly understand the problem that we are trying to engage with. Social problems, environmental problems too, have very complex structures of cause and effect, and we need to make sure we truly understand what is going on in a particular context. And that leads us to the question of knowledge. Who actually knows best about a social problem? And of course, there are many experts who know an awful lot. Many of my colleagues at LSE are professional, like a doctor or a teacher. There's a lot of expertise there. There's expertise with you as social entrepreneurs. But there's also, of course, huge experience and knowledge about social problems within the communities that we are trying to help. So there's a very interesting question there. Who knows best, the social entrepreneur, the expert, or the community who has the lived experience? And the answer is, I think, not one or the other, but all have a particular knowledge and expertise to bring to a social problem. The important thing here is that we give space to hear the story, hear the experience of those we are trying to help. And that final bullet point, I think, makes a very important point, which is engaging with local knowledge is not only sensible in that it might help us create a much better intervention or idea if we really have as much knowledge as possible about a particular problem. So that's an instrumental function. But to engage with local people, to hear them, to listen to them, well, that's also an act of empowerment and respect in and of itself. So let me show you what can go wrong if we don't fully understand the needs of a user. These are two examples from the field of gender equality, if taken from a fantastic book called Invisible Women. So one question was, why are there so few female concert pianists? The typical normative response was, of course, well, maybe women aren't very good musically, or they're not talented, or they don't want to be concert pianists. The real answer was that concert pianos were too large for women's hands. And it was only a male concert pianist with small hands relative to other men who was able to interpret this and create different types of piano. So it's an example of an assumption being made about how to create a product without fully engaging with users, and with making certain moral assumptions, or in this case, gendered assumptions. The second example I have is of car accidents. And quite remarkably, if you had the same sort of accident, women are 47% more likely to suffer serious injuries, 17% more likely to die. Why is that? It's because the crash test dummies, which were used to test out the safety of cars, used the male anatomy and not the female anatomy. Of course, that seems quite extraordinary, but it happened, and it happened with clever people. So that's an example from the field of gender, but of course we could expand that to fields of racial discrimination, to what it is to be disabled, to what it is to be in a marginalized or disadvantaged situation, a situation of poverty. Unless we truly engage with the knowledge and experience and characteristics of those we are trying to help, we're going to end up with poor responses and poor impact. So there's an instrumental reason why we should, in some sense, yield our power and listen to others. So on the topic of knowledge, here are a few tips. First of all, when you are trying to understand a social problem, challenge yourself. What don't I know? And through whose eyes am I looking? Am I looking at this particular social problem through my own eyes, in my case as a white middle class academic at the London School of Economics? Are those the right eyes through which to understand this social problem? Place the experience of the user absolutely at the centre. Listen to the users and communities that you are seeking to help. Find out what they need and what their experiences are, but crucially, understand their insights about what possible solutions might be. Which leads me to my final point. Never start with your own idea. To impose your own idea on a situation or a context is an act of power, and it could be an act of power which leads to unfortunate consequences. So first of all, understand the problem and the community that you are dealing with, and then think about how you can use your ideas, of which you will have many, to improve the situation for that community. So that's the first set of ideas about power, and that is make sure you truly understand and appreciate that you don't have all the knowledge about a social problem. Second tip, it's around something called system change, which is about really making sure we deeply change the structures, systems, conversations that are going on in society, and therefore we have long-term significant social change. And to ask the question, what particular mode of action am I going to use which best addresses the social problem, and in particular which challenges any imbalances of power and empowers those who are marginalized or disadvantaged? So to put it rather simply, we could take two particular views, and I'm not going to say either of these is right or wrong. I'm going to say which of these you use really depends on the particular situation, the particular task you are trying to fulfill. But first of all, we could use what I'm calling technical change, and that is technical solutions at an individual level to empower marginalized communities. And there are some examples there, a smartphone, microcredit, EdTech. So take the example of a smartphone. If you enable a marginalized community of some kind to have access to a smartphone when they might not otherwise have that, and when much of the rest of the population does, that is a great inclusive moment. It enables, in some sense, that community, if they so wish, to connect to the world of opportunity in a way that they are not able to do. And I talked to someone who worked in this field, who worked for a large charity which was giving aid and grants to farmers in Africa. And he did an informal survey and talked to people who were working in agriculture and said, what is the single most empowering thing we could do for you? And they said, give us a smartphone. So that's an example of technical change being a real empowering moment. Of course, when I'm talking about smartphones, I have to acknowledge that smartphones also have all sorts of harms associated with them. So while I'm advantaging some people by the extractive nature of the minerals and so on that are necessary for constructing a smartphone, can create great imbalances of power and harm to other people. I'm not entirely convinced the smartphone empowers children. I think it probably creates situations of great disempowerment for children, given the harms that we know from social media and so on. So it's a complicated picture. But the main point is that technical change can in some way empower. On the other hand, there are certain types of problems, some situations which require something bigger and more disruptive than a technical change at the individual level. And that is issues around, for instance, labour rights, preventing domestic violence, land rights for those who are being pushed off land in particular countries or in urban and rural situations. And in those cases, what we really need is government action. We need big social pressure on the companies that are committing labour rights abuses. We need activism and campaigning. So the locus of power switches from the individual level to the level of institutions and government. which of those, as I said, you choose, which mode of action you choose to utilize, really does depend on the particular social problem that you have understood to be present. One point I would make, and I think it's a very important one, is that it's very tempting to take control of activism and campaigning. One of the most important things is to let the community lead in their own empowerment, whether it's a gender, race, or class issue. There's an encouraging development in the philanthropic field in this space to try and attempt to allow communities to take control of their own voice. One of the most intriguing things I've encountered recently is the idea of activist councils. So you have a very wealthy philanthropist who is giving money to these social movements, but they understand that if they were to direct that social movement to certain objectives or to certain tactics or even to certain processes or definitions of the end game, that would be an act of power. And it would sort of go against the whole idea of a social movement for emancipation. So I have seen people giving away large sums of money, but not taking any responsibility for where that goes. They give it to an activist council or very experienced people in the field of gender equality, for instance. And it is those people, those grassroots people, who decide where the funds should go. So again, it's important we always think about what are the power implications of how we are doing our social action. Okay, I will now pass over to Kerin to talk about co-production.
Thanks, Jonathan. This is such an important conversation, and I think often we don't challenge enough where power sits specifically when we're looking at development and social change. And so Jonathan's talking and introduced us to the concepts around how our approach to development is shifting to give communities more ownership and more power in terms of the work that's being done. And I'd like to really flag an important point here, which is that when we look at our history of charity, of how we are all culturally conditioned, irrespective of the cultures and country contexts that we have been brought up in, but how we are all culturally conditioned to help, to do good, we have these intentions that are very anchored in philosophies of charity. And I've got a picture here on the slide of Lady Bountiful, these Victorian concepts of going out and helping the poor people who are generally outside of your front door, and you're helping them to better themselves. Now, there's nothing wrong with this underlying philosophy, except there is so much wrong with this philosophy when we start looking at it through the lens of power. Because what happens with our understanding of charity, which is very much anchored in this feeling of benevolence, I am doing good, and therefore I am good, is that the power resides in me, the giver. The recipient has very little power in this relationship. The giver is the person who determines what is given, when it's given, and the conditions around that giving. And in doing so, in maintaining this control over how we give to who, when, and in what circumstances, we perpetuate the power imbalance rather than build the bridges that we need to equalize the power imbalance. This is not to say that charity is wrong, but what I'm trying to say is that we really need to interrogate our own approaches to how we do good if we really want to fundamentally shift the power imbalances that exist, and importantly, fundamentally shift inequality, which occurs in so many realms and dimensions that we work in social change. So there are obviously multiple ways that we can do this, but one of the best examples that I've come across recently is doing some analysis on the social and solidarity economy across the African continent. There's wonderful work that's happening. This is the Mbindi self-help group. A dam is being built, being driven by a local, large, well-established nonprofit organization. You would think that the act of building a dam in of itself is sufficiently good. But what we see here is, how do you engage with the local community to first determine, is a dam what is needed? What are the real issues around water scarcity? Where should the dam be built? So we're drawing on very fundamental indigenous knowledge, practices, and systems here. How should the dam be built? And importantly, once we've had this big infrastructure build, which is quite common in the nonprofit space because it's project-based, it's easy to fund, there's a beginning and an end date. But then who owns the dam? And here we will come into some quite interesting discussions around organizational form and ownership. But in this instance, the dam management committee is drawn from the local community who actively then have been involved not just in the design and building of the dam, but also in how water as a resource is allocated. I've put there at the end of the slide asset-based community development approaches when we look for frameworks of co-production. ABCD, as it very nicely simplifies to as an acronym, is a wonderful approach. And fundamental to this philosophy is don't ask people what they need. Let's rather work with communities to identify what they have and to together identify what the steps of progress are. Head on to my next slide, which is why on the value of organizational design. So the thing about organizational form is that this is very much how we signal our intention around equalizing power. So again, it's not enough to say you're doing good or to assume you're doing good. And often we talk about, I'm going to change the world. And this also is a philosophy that we should shy away from because you're changing the world to what and in whose vision. Always we keep in the back of our minds, where does the power reside? And how? What is the power that I have as a social agent? And how do I want to convert that power dynamic so that the power rests with the beneficiaries, the service users, the customers, the people I work with? And one of the biggest signals we have of how we shift power is through the organizational design and the organizational form that we use to operationalize our social intention. So the important questions to ask here is, who has ownership? Who has control? Who's carrying the risk? And often a very quick and easy way to identify where power resides is, what is the resource flow? Where does the money, how is money brought into an organization and who does it flow to? Does it benefit an individual or does it benefit the collective or the group that is benefiting from the social work that we are doing together? And so on the next slide, I've got a couple of examples, but there are wonderful examples out there in multiple country contexts of how organizational forms such as cooperatives, mutuals, societies such as classics would be burial societies and their membership bases, credit unions, social enterprises, and the community interest company model that we see here in the UK all manage their resources, shifting the power so that the beneficiary or the customer is always benefiting throughout the system. The resources, the value that is developed through these organizations is then shared back down into the communities that benefit rather than being extracted out towards purposes of self-interest. A couple of examples here. Fan knows very well Gramal, which is a farmers data cooperative working in India, one of the beneficiaries of the 100X incubator program that is run from the Marshall Institute. This is such an exciting idea, recognizing the difficulties farmers in India have in accessing data so that they can make decisions around when to plant, how to plant, what resources they need. Farmers provide that information, but what's really exciting is that the technical platform that they provide that information to is owned by the farmers themselves. You see how the power shifts from a I'm doing good model for you. So we talk about social entrepreneurship with and alongside rather than social entrepreneurship for. Other exciting examples, but please feel free to look them up. Have a look at Seed of Hope, a UK-based nonprofit working in the mental health sphere, whose mental health service users are its governance and board, and Zenzeleni Community Networks from my country, South Africa, where communities own the last mile of telecoms access. The villages own the telecoms masts, and it's proving to be a wonderful model to bring resource and revenue back into very rural, isolated communities. I'm going to hand back to Jonathan for the last set of slides before we open for questions.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you, Karen. So the final skill or way of thinking I'd like to introduce is something about markets. Social entrepreneurs often may use a market-based organization to create social change. By that, I mean they are using some sort of commercial system to allocate resources. So you are selling vital goods and services to disadvantaged communities rather than allocating them in any other way. So what would be an alternative allocation? Well, it would be giving them out on a highly subsidized or charitable basis, or it would be campaigning to governments that these goods and services should be, for instance, delivered by government. And of course, I'm sure many of you are aware, markets are highly controversial. There are some, as we will see, who would say they are deeply disempowering. They are a privatization of our social life. They are a privatization of the public good. There are others who would say, drawing on Adam Smith, that actually markets are truly empowering. So what I wanted to look at here is, if you are a social entrepreneur, what approach should you take to delivery through the market? Now, an important point here is that power is not the only consideration at all when you are thinking about whether you can use the market or not. Of course, there are fundamental questions like, will a market be possible with the particular community that I am trying to help? But our focus here for this particular session is on the power implications of the market. So I'm going to go through three propositions about the use of markets and whether they empower or disempower. The first proposition is that when someone becomes a consumer, then they get power. And there's this very interesting and influential quotation from an academic called Greg Bees, who was one of the founders of the modern social entrepreneurship movement. And he said that when you charge the poor for a valuable product or service, then they get some sort of autonomy and agency. They have the right to complain. They have the right not to buy this product, instead of being grateful recipients of whatever charity, as Karen's been describing, or whatever charity gives to them. And there's a certain instinctive, intuitive power in this particular argument. And I have put this to some people from disadvantaged communities, and they do get it, that this is something that enables them to really take control of their lives rather than waiting for an NGO to do something for them. So that's the first suggestion. I do, of course, have some caveats that you could raise about this. The first one, of course, is that markets, unless you do some sort of amendment to them, can be highly unequal and inequitable, unfair. So most of all, what happens if someone can't pay? Do you then cut them off from this important social good? So equity is our first consideration. The other point I would make is not all of us are confident consumers. The ability to work in a market, to make those complaints that Greg Bees has mentioned, well, that does really rely on a whole lot of personal characteristics. And some of the most vulnerable people may not be able to operate very well in the market and may therefore be in some sense exploited. So that's a suggestion that the consumer gets more power in the market. To turn the lens around, a second proposition is that being a business owner gives people power. So here we're saying that the job of social entrepreneurship is to enable communities themselves to own businesses and so on. So especially important when you have conditions of some kind of oppression and poverty. One could argue this, for instance, in certain marginalized communities in the US, that some kind of self-reliance and entrepreneurship could be a means of empowerment. One example of action in this field, which is following this principle, is the Equality Fund, a very fascinating new philanthropic foundation, which is investing in women-led businesses or businesses that are producing products and services specifically for women. the idea here is that you create power for a particular community which is being discriminated against by enabling them to control their own economy, to control their own businesses. So that's a really interesting take on this idea of the market and power. Someone who has actually, strange enough, put this rather well is the American musician Pharrell Williams, who has done a fantastic song called Entrepreneur. And I do advise you to take a look at the video, which is very accessible online. And I found myself deeply emotional when I was watching this video. And I'd love you to watch it too and think, why does one feel emotional? Why is this such a powerful message? And his message was that communities in particularly Black communities in the US have been seriously disadvantaged, and now it is up to them to take control. Stop sitting around. If you can't buy the building, stock the shelf, and then keep on stacking until you can own that organization yourself. Now, again, I'm going to offer some very strong caveats about this, because in a situation of structural disadvantage, it's extremely hard for people to own a business for themselves. So this does need considerable and thoughtful support and structuring. But nonetheless, it is a very interesting aspiration. The final proposition argues against these points I've been making and says that, no, we really shouldn't go down the route of the private market, because the private market is indeed owned by shareholders and private actors, and fundamentally power resides with them. Really, we should locate power truly in citizenship and politics, not in consumerism, by allowing private ownership of key services, delivery of schools, energy, health, as some philanthropists and some social entrepreneurs advocate. We're actually disempowering citizens. These decisions about important values, about important services, must be made at the level of government and political discourse. So in most circumstances, advocates of this position would say, actually, we should try and avoid market-based solutions if we can. Now, perhaps disappointingly, I'm not going to take a particular view on this. What I am going to say is that it depends on the particular field situation that you are working with. Sometimes social entrepreneurs are working in situations where government provision is not a realistic proposition in the near future. Therefore, you may have no option but to move to a market model in order to make your organization sustainable. In those circumstances, are there ways in which you can manipulate or change, for instance, your fee structure in order to allow everybody to participate in the services that you are delivering? So that's a few thoughts about a fundamental decision that many social entrepreneurs face. Should I go towards a market model? Should I go towards a charitable model? Okay, so that's a set of five skills that we wanted to introduce to you. And we've gone through them very quickly, but they do actually offer quite a comprehensive view of situations of power for the social entrepreneur, in some cases a philanthropist too, and how you might deal with them. So we talked about how you ensure that you don't impose your own knowledge on a situation. We talked about the mode of action that you might want to take, whether it's dealing with power through technical solutions or whether it's dealing with power through activism and politics. We talked about the importance of working with people, enabling them to make decisions, not just you. We talked about the absolutely critical importance of how we organize for social change. Where does the power lie in terms of the resources and governance of the organizations that are driving social change? And we finished off with a discussion about markets. This is a hard job. This is a really hard job. It requires humility from all of us who are acting in this field. It requires empathy, but it requires more than empathy. I sometimes have a problem with the term empathy in that it seems somewhat patronizing. It seems to imply that the person who has empathy in some sense has power over the people we are having empathy for. But it does require some sort of fellow feeling. It requires you to be resilient. But I think most of all, the real dilemma for the social entrepreneur is if you are passionate about what you're doing, if you are so filled with the importance of solving this social problem that it keeps you awake at night, how can you have the ability to let power go? How can you let others make decisions? How can you devolve to people who you think might not be able to make decisions as well as you? That is a really, really difficult skill to take on, and one on which we should all, I think, reflect. So that's what we have to say about managing power as a social change agent. Just to let you know that we have all sorts of activities at the Marshall Institute. You should hear more about the sort of work we do. We have our executive master's program in social business and entrepreneurship. We have a short 8-week online certificate course in social entrepreneurship. And we also have the remarkable 100X Impact Accelerator, which Fan mentioned a moment ago. So please do contact us if you'd like to investigate any of these opportunities, or actually, if you would just like to continue this conversation, we would love to hear from you. Okay, Fan, over to you for question and answer.
Perfect. And thank you so much, both. For me, at least, incredibly informative and insightful, not least of the 5 kind of pillars you've set out so clearly. But also, Pharrell Williams, I was not expecting that as part of this session, which I really enjoyed. And we'll go and check out that song thereafter. So we do have a couple of questions coming through, which I'll make a start on those. So firstly, we have one from Charlie. And the question really centers around, and I'll reframe it slightly from the perspective of how can one's own influence, I guess, the broader system that you operate in, whereby how can you influence government to really disperse power to the people to drive social change if apathy towards politics limits such participation, especially for those who can be potentially quite passionate for change? And I will leave it to you to kind of fight out on who wants to respond to that.
An amazingly important question, and I take the point entirely. I mean, there are 2 things I would say to that. The first is that we can perceive problems of apathy, but there are still people who are deeply passionate who are working in this field, and I am fortunate enough to meet them every day. So I meet people who are campaigning on gender equality, racism, and when you get beneath the surface, there is an extraordinary number of new organizations and new ideas that are developing in these fields. And I think one of the other problems we have is that these tremendously passionate views are not being heard. You know, there's also that gap in the political system between that sort of voice and getting political action. The manifestos being published are positively bland and vanilla in the UK, and I imagine it's similar elsewhere. But to your point, what do we do about apathy? I think, you know, this is something where we as social entrepreneurs have a role. I see fantastic organizations which are going into schools and saying it is vitally important that you understand activism. It's vitally important that you understand what it is to be a citizen. And that is the sort of work we have to do. It's really hard work, but we have to challenge that apathy and challenge people to understand they need to take control of their own power in the political system. So there's no easy answer to that, but I think it's that sort of work that we need to undertake.
Karen, anything to add?
No, I think Jonathan covered it well. I'm South African. We've just had our elections, and I think what's been really good is that there's been some very clear feedback that's come through from citizens who have felt disempowered. I think what's really important is to recognize also, and I think this is what's quite important about the social entrepreneurship narrative, is that it gives us power as citizens at a local level. And often we assume that our only ways of engaging with the political structures is, you know, every 5 years when we have an election. But the opportunity to take steps towards change, you know, citizenship is really about not being apathetic, and it's not about sitting back and accepting imbalances in power. And I think this is very much the philosophy that underpins social entrepreneurial action, which is what can I do, and how can I as an individual identify the collective within which I'm working and within which we can improve circumstances. So those circumstances can happen at a very local level. And I think often when we talk about social entrepreneurship, we tend to ignore very strong, powerful Indigenous action that takes place amongst community-based organizations, for example. It's not always the big political structures where big movement happens. And I think we must all fight against being apathetic, but that citizenship happens at all levels of systems change.
Great. Thank you for that. And My next question is one from Maria, and it really, I guess, covers the topic at the other end of the spectrum, where it actually takes on this system change lens in the sense of, and she gives the great example of, for example, climate change being a global issue, and where you would need participation, activation, alignment from all sorts of stakeholders across the different levels that you just touched on, Karen. And is there any case to be made for people to be involved who are not core part of the community that you're really trying to serve or crafting a solution around? And what are some of the, you know, challenges or opportunities that you foresee within that context?
So I'm going to jump in with a quick point before I hand the bulk of the answer over to Jonathan. But I think what's important here is how we define communities. We tend to see communities as geographic or ethnic or cultural, but essentially how we define and engage with communities is really important. Underpinning this, and I see it coming through in the following questions, is also these concepts of othering, that I'm an outsider and therefore not part, or I can't participate within. I think essentially the underlying philosophies that Jonathan was talking about in terms of humility, empathy, are very much about how do we engage as equals to together identify what progress looks like. We will always be outsiders in some system, and our work is always to identify how we can step into systems so that we can progress change together. Jonathan, on that, I'll hand over to you.
No, I agree absolutely. I feel like there are almost two different questions within Mariah's most interesting contribution. I think one thing is, shouldn't we just leave it to communities in a sense and not have people outside the community coming in to do change? I think that there is one, I think, slightly dangerous proposition which sometimes comes through from the sort of presentation that Karen and I have just made, and that is, communities must be self-reliant and do it themselves. And of course, that is to some extent what we're arguing, that communities have to have control. They should have the final say. They have the expertise. But when we have societies which are fundamentally hugely unequal, such as the two places that Karen and I come from, the UK and South Africa, then there has to be support of some kind to disadvantaged communities from the outside. And the key thing here is, well, that can be resources, of course, but it also can be expert skills, because those communities don't have certain skills. And the real challenge is how you bring in those people with money who have power, those people who have skills and expertise who have power, but do it in such a way that the community retains control. And I also firmly believe, I mean, Karen's talked about the notion of community. One of the problems with communities is they are exclusive. And one of the challenges in our societies is too many communities are not connecting together. So the more we can encourage communities of whatever kind, as Karen said, to interact with each other, that's highly beneficial. Very quickly on climate change, that's obviously an extremely difficult challenge. And my instance, not very helpful answer, is that ultimately climate change is of such an order and requires such kind of incentives to be tackled that it has to be done at government level and beyond that at international level. And therefore, of my modes of action, I would say activism and political action is the way forward on climate change.
Thank you. So let me take us into the next set of questions, which starts from Richard, but is kind of built on by Emma, and is really focused around how does one influence and support communities to take power back, especially from those who may be perceived as unwilling to kind of give up on that power. And in an even worse case scenario, where you are, as you do go through this process, potentially losing your own power in kind of doing so. And maybe I'll give this question to Jonathan to start with.
Great question, because you're right. In a sense, this makes no sense, because what we're talking about is people with particular class interests or other kinds of interests, you know, male interests, particular racial interests, because they have power. Why on earth would they give it up? And there are, of course, some arguments both from morality but also from interests. And one thing I've noted recently is the beginning of a discourse amongst more advantaged people that what if inequality does get to such a stage in some developed countries that people become restless? You know, we need to do something about that. So there are certain interests. It's not very it's not a very nice thing to say, but there is some interest in tackling inequality for that reason. Increasingly, there is some kind of movement around social justice by those who do have resources, which is really intriguing. I'm not going to say it's big and mainstream, but it really is there. And it's especially associated with what we call next generation wealthy people, people who've inherited wealth from their parents and have got some sort of generational view on injustice. And I am noticing increasingly those people being willing to give away their power. The other aspect is that we are also beginning to see the emergence of marginalized communities themselves with access to their own philanthropic resources. And that is one way in which we can move this sort of agenda forward. So we can see gender equality philanthropy, race-based philanthropy, and so on. But there is a larger and much bigger political question here, which is why, how we can get social change if the wealthy are in charge of, for instance, the media and maybe political institutions and so on. And I probably don't have time to answer that particular one here, but it's an important point.
So I think we have about 10 minutes left in this session. So I'm going to take two more questions from the audience before I kind of close this. Thank you so much for all the interesting questions coming through. And obviously, Jonathan and Karen for taking all those questions. So the next one is really on the point about who enacts change. And it's a question that's come through LinkedIn. What do you say to communities who complain about the additional burden that's involved? And that burden really speaks to perhaps deconstructing some of the existing structures that's kind of been set up that may not have had the involvement of communities in the first place. So how do you really go about creating that shift and shifting the mindset of communities to be more involved in kind of creating change for themselves and kind of the broader system? And I'll go to Karen first for that question, if I may.
So I'm going to rephrase this question, which is a bit of a privileged, powerful position that you have put me in. But I don't think it's about asking communities. I'm going to give a different example, which is we're busy working on understanding the social and solidarity economy in the African context, for example. So multiple country contexts, different cultural backgrounds, language groups, colonial histories. And one of the themes that is really emerging so strongly is how the legislative systems in African countries are anchored in colonial legislative structures and this is now deeply embedded in institutions such as the judiciary. We were talking earlier about political systems, but essentially this has happened at the expense of indigenous systems, which are ignored and are relegated to being considered as informal and therefore somehow lesser. And what's really important, as we see, I don't know if everybody on the call knows, but there's been some wonderful advances over the last couple of years in strengthening the policy environment for the social and solidarity economy, for example, with a big debate happening at the UN General Assembly this year. So there's a big focus on these institutional structures that can really legitimize these concepts of the social and solidarity economy and social entrepreneurship. But what do you do in country contexts where you're now imposing a concept of what this is when the legislative system is already quite far removed from the cultural values and norms? So I've twisted the question a little, but I hope what I'm saying is positioning, is creating another angle on the question. I think there are a few things to say here. Number one, I certainly don't have the answers and I don't profess to, but I do think we have to continuously keep exploring how we can be more sensitive, understanding and recognize the legitimacy that sits in situations that are non-Western. And part of this is recognizing the power that we give to the Western context and impose that on other country scenarios. And in doing so, consistently strive to empower those who don't look what we think normal looks like, and give voice. And I know that that's not an answer and it might sound a little bit soft and fuzzy, but I think we need to acknowledge the extent of the complexity and depth of the institutions that we've established and how we build bridges to connect between Western and Indigenous value systems. Sorry that I can't be more, here's a perfect answer, but I think we have to be sensitive to the complexity of it.
And it's a very complex topic. Jonathan, anything to add?
If I understood the question correctly, is the disturbance to communities in some sense by this sort of action? I'm going to twist this side like Karen and say there is a fundamental problem here that, of course, we are brushing over, which is if as a social entrepreneur or expert, you go in there and think this community is getting it wrong, how do we respond to that? And again, there's no easy answer to that, because community self-determination implies that communities can get it wrong. And when I say get it wrong, not just in the technical issues that they use, but also in their, as we might think, moral judgments. And then we have to decide whose moral judgments should be more favorable. Is it us coming from the United Nations Convention on Human Rights, or is it whatever the local community is deciding, and so on? And these are really impenetrable philosophical questions, but which every day the social entrepreneur might have to deal with.
So one last question from the audience. And it really is an interesting one, which really goes into the concept of power that we've been talking about, where it may be quite highly contested in terms of that definition. So I'm curious to learn from you both in terms of what definition of power have you settled for?
Yeah, very good question. I'll give a very superficial answer. I mean, the first thing is we're talking about positive freedom rather than negative freedom. And that is, you know, not the freedom from being interfered with, but the freedom to be able to do things. And that's what we're thinking that the social entrepreneur enables, the freedom for a community to do things of their own volition, which they want to do. The second thing I would say is that I'm building into this some sense of autonomy, the idea of individuals and communities having the freedom to develop their own life and their own biography precisely as they would wish to, without any constraints being imposed by the philanthropist or the social entrepreneur. Even as I say that, there is, of course, a tension, because the autonomy of the community may not necessarily reflect the autonomy of individuals, which is again something we have to deal with. But that gives a very, very short idea of how we're thinking about power. Karen, do you want to add anything to that?
Thank you. I thought that was spot on. I would also just like to add, it's great to see your question, Ali. I mean, thank you. I've become quite allergic to definitions, and I think this is a consequence of working in the field of social entrepreneurship and going back to the point earlier in terms of appreciating different interpretations within this highly complex field of what is good, what is social, who's benefiting who. And I keep going back, as Jonathan has said, around always checking how we engage and what our position is in the system, because ultimately that's possibly the power that we have. And so I know I'm sidestepping the question by not providing a definition, but I think in this field, we are constantly checking and challenging our own knowledge and assumptions. And I think that holds in this scenario too.
I don't agree more. And I think that's all the time we have, sadly, for today. As Jonathan mentioned, if you are fascinated by this topic, then please do go online, check out the Marshall Institute, check out our program, check out 100X. Thank you so much to Karen and Jonathan for your time today and for all the insights that you've shared. Again, really valuable for me, and I'm sure for the audience who spent time with us today as well. And thank you to the audience for joining this workshop, which is part of the Free Public LSE Festival that's taking place across this week. And please do go online to find out more about other events taking place as well.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.